So how are you?
Good evening. Thanks for tuning in to the International Press Review. I'm your host, Jim Nelson. We're taping this program on Sunday, August 11th, 2024. The International Press Review reviews news from different regions of the world, giving the listeners to this program a perspective and analysis of international news not often heard in the corporate mainstream media. This evening's panel is Yukari Miyamai, Yukari reviewing the Japanese press. Good evening, Yukari.
Good evening. Thank you.
Joe Juhas, Joe reviewing the Eastern and Western European press. Good evening, Joe.
Good evening, Jim. Good evening, my fellow panelists. Jó estét kívánok, jó napot kívánok, kedves hallgatóim.
And Doug Vaughn. Doug covers news from Central and South America, as well as the Caribbean basin. Good evening, Doug.
Todo bien, buenas noches. Hello, everybody.
Good one. All right. Yukari, go ahead with the Japanese press.
Okay, so this August marks 79th year since the historic U.S. atomic bombing on Hiroshima, Nagasaki in 1945. August 6 and August 9 got the two atomic bomb on Japan's soil. The world had witnessed an instant and indiscriminate genocide brought on by humanity's first usage of a nuclear bomb against civilian population. Since then, city of Hiroshima and Nagasaki have hosted memorial ceremony service every year to commemorate over 250,000 victims and to renew commitment to peace and call for nuclear disarmament. As survivors of two nuclear bombings are slowly dying off, the future role of this commemoration service is as uncertain. Also, the narratives of victimhood in the post-World War II Japan is crumbling when the world is facing another wave of fascism and racism. This year, Hiroshima Mayor Kazumi Masui had made an explicit speech against genocide, past and present, during the national TV live broadcast, describing genocide in graphic details. Governor of Hiroshima Prefecture, Hidehiko Yusaki, also made a powerful speech with anti-war message, referring to the struggle of indigenous people of Japan in ancient time, where we cannot escape seeing the resemblance to the current struggle against genocide in Palestine. For both speeches, NHK's TV camera focused on Israeli ambassador in attendance, catching his angry reaction. The NHK is a national broadcasting organization, just like BBC. In contrast, Nagasaki Mayor Shiro Suzuki had announced that the city of Nagasaki is not inviting Israel, but inviting ambassador of Palestine, for the first time instead. In defiant response, collective West, meaning US, UK, France, Germany, Italy, Canada, and EU, had boycotted the Nagasaki peace ceremony. The cancellation of the Nagasaki ceremony by G7 and the EU demonstrate their commitment to Israel's ongoing genocide policy against Palestine people, but also illustrate their view of genocide in racial and pro-colonial context. Just to be clear, Russia and Belarus were also not invited, along with Israel, to Hiroshima and Nagasaki ceremony. Prime Minister of Japan, Mr. Kishida is actually from Hiroshima, but his speech in Hiroshima and Nagasaki ceremony were almost identical to the previous speech, which were also given by his predecessor, Mr. Abe, Prime Minister Abe. Mr. Kishida's appeal to abolish nuclear weapon also reminds us that Japan has yet to sign international treaty banning nuclear weapons. So there is a lot of hypocrisy going on. Nagasaki mayor's break from status quo ceremonial routine, which has been going on for decades, invoked strong backlash domestically and internationally. This marks a significant milestone for Japan since the end of World War II. While central government of Japan, led by Prime Minister Kishida and dominated by Liberal Democratic Party, is closely tied to U.S. foreign policy. But municipality-level politics in Japan increasingly reflect multipolar geopolitics of the world. One of the reasons is that local communities are abandoned by the central government. For example, multiple natural disasters like earthquake, flood, typhoon disaster, and also nuclear accident in rural community had not received adequate emergency assistance or recovery effort from the central government of Japan. Actually, for decades like that. For example, Fukushima nuclear accident site is still leaking high dosage of radiation and devastating as earthquake victims in multiple rural communities are still buried in rubble. Another reason is that the highly educated intellectual sector has found more meaningful social, political, and policy work environment in local municipalities. In recent years, especially after Fukushima disaster, smaller local municipalities have produced progressive mayors, including multiple female mayors and policymakers, who have been implementing innovative ordinance and regulation to address local-level social programs. So there is some kind of separation between the central government of Japan and local politics in Japan, which usually are not very visible, especially from United States. By the way, I just wanted to remind listeners who may not realize that current U.S. ambassador to Japan is former Chicago Mayor Rahm Emanuel. He's planning to leave the post in November, according to yesterday's news report. When asked about U.S. boycotting Nagasaki peace ceremony, U.S. State Department spokesperson Matthew Miller said, No country should have been singled out to not to be invited to this celebration. His usage of the word celebration was shocking, but now I remember seeing President Obama smiling and clapping his hand when the video of Hiroshima bombing was shown during a 70th anniversary commemoration of D-Day in 2014, while Russian President Putin was crossing his heart with prayer at the same moment. So I am more aware that the G7 countries see genocide differently than the rest of the world. And I have just a small comment. I don't have a lot to say about this, but maybe other panelists can make a comment. China is serving as a mediator between Iran and Saudi Arabia for their improved diplomacy. And 12 factions within Palestine were invited to China and signed Peking Agreement to form United Advocacy. And Yemen and Saudi Arabia also come to a historic agreement for alliance. So things are changing, and I wish Ibrahim was here to comment on that. But if anybody could make a comment, that would be great. Thank you.
Well, I mean, I guess one thing you can say is that the influence of China in world affairs is enormously on the rise, as is the role of China in absolutely everything other than aggressive warfare or colonization. So it's a situation that's extends to its role as a mediator in the Middle East, while the United States is, as you have, I think, very well pointed out, Yukari, sort of chained to the Israeli ultra right. There's
Well,
some thoughts.
I think we should just move on and thank you, Yukari, for that news from Japan. And we will now, that was Yukari Miyamai reviewing the news from Japan. And now we'll move on to Joe Yuhas reviewing Western and Eastern European press. Go ahead, Joe.
Go ahead, Joe. Well, there you are. So I would like to begin, as I usually do, by saying that I see my role here, as in other programs we do, as somebody who reports news that is not part of sort of like the storytelling of the mainstream media in the West, particularly the American mainstream media. And that when I give a report, unless I say otherwise, my giving the report doesn't mean that I am endorsed the content of whatever I am reporting on. So that's a kind of general introduction. So we're recording this program on the 11th of August at 6 in the evening Mountain Time. And just to show you how far ahead I am of things, I am going to report to you from a report by TASS, the government news agency in Russia, that is dated August 12th. 2024. So, how about that? I'm reporting on the future. Just to make sure people understand that it's 8 and more hours later in Russia than it is in Boulder. So it is absolutely today's news. And I have searched high and low in the American press and other press on this report, and I have not seen it mentioned yet. I find it extremely difficult to imagine that TASS is simply making up a story. So I just wonder, is this something that's going to be carried by the news somewhere tomorrow, elsewhere, or what is the reason we can think about that? In any case, TASS reports that the Ukrainians have made another attack on the Zaporizhzhia nuclear power plant as of today, Moscow, August the 12th. And that according to the Rosatom, the Russian Atomic Agency, this can be characterized as an act of nuclear terrorism. So apparently, or TASS claims, or the Russian Rosatom claims, that a strike was delivered targeting the cooling water of the power plant, which was in standard operation mode. Just to refresh the minds of our listeners, this power plant was, and you can say is, in Ukraine. But very early on in the war, the Russians captured it. And it is, in fact, the largest nuclear power plant in Europe.
Joe, can I add something?
Only if you say please.
Please.
Go right ahead, sir.
I did see a news report before we came on. I can't remember the agency. It might have been Reuters, talking about this very incident. And the Ukrainians are blaming the Russians. Starting the fire or the
Starting the
bomb that went.
fire. Well, you know.
I also have seen that particular news like 4 hours ago. And the one that I saw was that z this is like a Zelensky's attack on Russia, how it was said that in but and I think that the source was Reuters as well.
So I didn't look at Reuters, and I'm glad to hear that apparently this is not something. I can tell you that I have searched high and low myself and found nothing, but something is much better than nothing, because if nothing else, it verifies that at least something happened. So, whether it is the Russians themselves or whether it's the Ukrainians, this is, to quote Yukari's report earlier, playing with fire. I mean, playing with an atomic power plant, whichever side is doing it, is not something highly recommended. It's dreadfully frightening. I find it dreadfully frightening. And that so far, I don't know. Doug, have you seen anything about it?
Oh, I would classify these as dueling rumors at this point. And yeah,
Okay.
I've seen a smattering of reports that cite both Russian and Ukrainian official sources off the record as blaming each other.
Okay. So there you go. We've got, yeah, the world playing with fire here. At the same time, for the first time in the war, the fight has moved into Russia proper, which is the invasion by Ukraine of the Kursk region. And this is something about which you see 200 million square miles of press coverage in the Western press. And with, I would say, enormous alarm at the potential consequences of an attack on the motherland itself. What I find kind of interesting and extraordinary at the same time, that my perusal of the Russian press for this press review, including TASS as well as several Russian newspapers, they are completely downplaying the importance of this incursion and are simply saying, oh yes, well, our troops are completely controlling the situation, nothing to be worried about, nothing to be alarmed about. Well, you could say that this is an attempt to pacify the Russian population, but of course, I am not reading for all my multilingual capacities. I do not read Russian. I mean, I know a few words of Russian. And what I read was TASS's English language service. And speaking in effect in English to an English-speaking audience about events in Russia and what they're saying, oh no, this ain't no big deal. Our troops are completely in control of the situation. So they're going, that is to say, the official Russian line is being very, very, very vociferously troubled by the possible events in the nuclear power plant within the territory of the Ukraine, which the Russia now controls, and not getting very excited about the Ukrainians successfully having penetrated into Russia and controlling, even if it's just a square meter of the motherland, and saying it ain't no big deal. So one can wonder why this upplay and downplay, and one can think about it as long as one wants to, but its very existence and the opposite way the weights are distributed on the scale in the Western plant press is a reason for pause and a reason for consideration. I guess I will not speak entirely for myself. The Ukrainian war is going through a very, very complex reassessment, I think, at all sides. This has a lot to do with something that Yukari mentioned earlier, namely, or which I responded to. Certainly, I think it's related to the rise of China. I think it's related to the ongoing war in the Middle East, and it is related to the, I will put it this way, and anybody feel free to disagree with me. This is not an opinion on my part. The failure of the West to cripple Russia in any sense, as I can see it, through the war in the Ukraine. The attempt by the West to starve Russia economically has, in my opinion, backfired. And the resultant, if there is one in Europe, is an increase in the power of Russia overall and a great crisis in Germany and some other parts of Europe, which had been completely dependent on Russian energy to get things going. So I guess enough on that story, and maybe time to move on to the next story. I am now going to give a translation of which I didn't do the translation of an article in the Russian newspaper Vedomosti, which does not have an English translation itself, which comments on the election situation in the United States, talking specifically about the choice of Waltz as a vice presidential nominee by Kamala Harris, says choice of Waltz as the vice presidential nominee. And this is the comment. The choice of Waltz is a strategically strong move. Head of Dubrovsky Consulting, Pavel Dubrovsky, told the newspaper. He, like Harris herself in 2020, has become a consensus figure within the Democratic Party. Waltz looks like a quote-unquote normal candidate. His initiatives on free school lunches, background as a teacher, and his public speaking style may appeal to white Americans who largely support Trump, the expert explained. So this newspaper is firmly in the Putin camp, and it is completely writing for Russian domestic consumption, and seems to indicate that there is a belief in Russia that by the Russian government, in effect, that this is not merely a honeymoon situation, and that the Democrats, knowingly or unknowingly, may have outmaneuvered Trump. By the timing of the retirement, in effect, of Biden and the line of succession to, so to say, fresh faces. Back to the ideas about China, I now switch to the Neue Zürcher Zeitung. This is the premier German new language newspaper in Switzerland, and many people in Europe consider it the number one newspaper in Europe, if for no other reason, because it has a kind of Swiss neutrality about it. And it is reporting on an attempt, which also I have not read about in the Western press, by the Americans and the EU to build their own railroad line in Africa to bring the natural resources of Africa to European and American markets instead of China. And the Neue Zürcher Zeitung, in effect, is saying too little, too late. That the Chinese have outmaneuvered the Europeans and the Americans in Africa as well as in Europe and in South America. And I think, the fact that there's this long analysis of this in the Neue Zürcher Zeitung is quite interesting. Here is another article from the Neue Zürcher Zeitung. I'm not going to read the whole thing, but it's a retrospective on the Biden presidency. And the headline says, Biden underestimated the Taliban and Putin. So this is kind of like the voice, the deep voice of Swiss neutrality on the situation in the world and the declining power of the West and of the United States, and not merely the fading, I mean, the opposite, the enormous energy of China, but also the resurgence of Europe, because here is the Neue Zürcher Zeitung. The Biden administration, and we know what they mean by that, basically the Ukrainian war, underestimated Putin, not to mention the Taliban. So I will do a very quick switch to the Frankfurter Allgemeine Zeitung, which is pretty much the premier newspaper in Germany. It does have an English language edition, and it is today re-examining the power of the American presidency, which it correctly identifies as being utterly ambiguous because he is, while it is quote unquote the Congress that must declare war, it is the president who's commander in chief of the armed forces. So there is this one military operation after another. So to me, this reflects a concern over potential actions by the United States, again reminding me of Yukari's very, very perceptive analysis. Let me just very, very quickly close with the last thought, which is that what we're dealing with is, as I see it from my sense of the things that I reported upon, an extremely slippery and dangerous situation in Europe, and that the European press has an understanding of it, not surprisingly, I suppose, that is deeper than that of the American press. So with that, I think I should hand over the microphone to Doug. Is that your sense also, Jim?
Yes, I was just about to say that this is a good time to wrap up your segment. So
What
thank you.
kind of a wrap do you suggest? Christmas wrap or birthday?
I like a combo.
Okay, let's do a
Combo
combo
gangster
and
rap.
let's go a combo and go on to Doug.
Yes. So thank you, Joe Juha's. That was Joe Juha's reviewing Eastern and Western European press. Now we'll move on to Doug Vaughn and Doug covering the Central and South American press as well as the Caribbean Basin. Go ahead, Doug.
Well, thank you. And I don't know if Joe heard me, but I recommended that he conclude with gangster rap.
Ah, I didn't hear that, and I'm taking it out right now, Doug. Thank you. I've got a whole bunch of it in my closet.
That's good. You can compete in the next Olympics as a breakdancer, too.
I'm already signed up.
We're celebrating this universal harmony in the middle of the chaos that the world is experiencing. And with that, I would like to acknowledge our friend Ibrahim and encourage our listeners to tune in to the most recent podcast that Ibrahim Kazaruni and Rob Prince did on the situation in the Middle East, and especially the most recent assassinations which occurred in Beirut and in Tehran, in which Israel, with possible complicity of the United States, is suspected of having been involved in the assassinations of leaders of Hamas and Hezbollah, putting the region on yet another precipice in which the expected retaliation on the part of Iran and Hezbollah in Lebanon could exceed those relatively well-rehearsed, announced, and orchestrated tit-for-tat kind of responses that occurred in the past. I urge people to listen very carefully to Rob and Ibrahim's analysis because, in the absence of Ibrahim tonight, I'm sure we would all and our listeners would benefit from that. From that conversation. That said, I want to refer to the ongoing controversy yet again in Venezuela with the recent election, January 28th, disputed by the Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro, who was reelected according to official tallies with about 51 plus almost 52% of the vote. And there was a turnout which was described in both local media and regional media as having been approaching 80% of the electorate. That vote, of course, is in dispute largely because the opposition candidacy of Edmundo Gonzalez was claiming, even before the votes were counted, that they would be the victim of systematic fraud on the part of the government of Venezuela. Those accounts, of course, have been widely reported in the corporate or mainstream media, not only here in the United States, but especially in Western Europe, where there has been an ongoing campaign to portray Maduro as a dictator who is resorting to fraud in re-election and repression as an authoritarian or aspiring to be an authoritarian when the vote didn't go his way. However, in Venezuela, you have a very substantial media, mostly aligned with the government and arguably owned and controlled by the existing government of Maduro, in the form of the TV operation called Telesur, which also includes English and other language broadcasts and podcasts and websites that contain news and analysis there. And I would also refer our listeners to the work of a friend and colleague for many years, Steve Ellner, Ellner, and encourage you to use your favorite search engine to look up anything that Steve Ellner has written about Venezuela. He spent 40 years as a professor of history at the University of the Oriente in Venezuela from 1977 until 2017, stayed in Venezuela a few more years, and then upon retirement, returned to the United States and continues to work for, among others, the most widely respected journal on Latin American political economy, which is Latin America Perspectives, where he's the assistant managing editor, associate editor. I will not, however, quote from those sources, but merely cite some of the headlines, which may not appear in the United States or in Western Europe. And for the benefit of our listeners, point out that Maduro, who was first elected in 2013 following the death of his predecessor and mentor and patron, Hugo Chavez, was also elected in 2018. But at that time, the United States refused to recognize the election of Maduro and backed the former speaker of the House of Representatives, if you were the National Assembly, Juan Guaido, who had never been elected to anything, but was rather a representative in a small district, largely backed by the former oligarchy or the very wealthy who had controlled Venezuela up until the election of Chavez in 1999. And beginning in even before the election of Maduro, there had been several attempts mounted with the support of the United States and its regional allies to overthrow Hugo Chavez, most notoriously during the 2002 to 2004 period under former US President George Bush. But then again, under Donald Trump, including an attempted assassination of Maduro by drone at a public event in 2019, or rather in 2020. So with that kind of background, it's important to recognize that Maduro, whatever the final tally is, and whether it is certified by the Venezuelan Supreme Court, has basically been walking a tightrope for the past 11 years. And there have been multiple attempts not only to overthrow him, backed by the United States and by, in some cases, right-wing forces in the United States that include the substantial Cuban-American community in South Florida and its allies in Venezuela, an alliance that's effectively gone on since 1959 when Venezuela was also arguably on the verge of a revolution, and the Central Intelligence Agency supplied right-wing Cuban exiles to the right-wing government of Venezuela to conduct counterinsurgency operations against insurgents, guerrilla forces that were allied then with Cuba. And some of those same elements of the earlier revolutionary efforts came to power along with Hugo Chavez and continue to be an important source of support for Maduro, although the Cuban government is largely bereft of any direct ability to affect events in Venezuela. Just by way of additional background to this, Venezuela, of course, is a substantial country. It has 30 million people. It's estimated that approximately 7 million of its citizens live abroad, including growing numbers, perhaps 2 million or more in the United States, in South Florida, in Texas, and of course in the Denver Boulder area, where there were large migrations of Venezuelans, some of whom were then bused to other areas over the past 3 to 4 years. On August 11th, that is today's news in Telesur, the Venezuelan state-supported but not technically state-controlled news outlet, which is the principal source of information from the government to the world. President Maduro appeared before the assembly of the Bolivarian National Guard, which is one of the elements of the military under his command as commander in chief. And one of the reasons this was an important event was because he basically issued a defiant challenge to the United States, saying that you, in this case, the Bolivian National Guard, which is in essence a kind of citizen militia, but trained and supported by the Army, the Air Force, and the Navy of Venezuela, and in essence, a kind of domestic security force as well. He said, "You are ready for anything, and we count on you to ensure that order, law, the Constitution, and the right to peace prevail for the people of Venezuela. We are guaranteeing you a free and not a slave homeland." This is largely interpreted as a response to the American, that is the U.S., and its allies in Western Europe and some of its allies in Central and South America, having refused to acknowledge his reelection. And I want to couple that with a story that appeared today in the Wall Street Journal and is being picked up throughout the world. It's based on the usual anonymous sources, but it says the United States is planning a last-ditch effort to offer amnesty to Maduro in exchange for his stepping down and leaving office. The journal's report claims that the United States has been discussing the possibility of pardoning Maduro in advance of indictments that have been held in secret on charges of having been involved in drug trafficking. Now, whether in fact these indictments are valid and whether in fact they could ever be affected would depend, of course, on the ability of the United States to extradite Maduro, which obviously is not going to happen if he's still the president. If he were to leave power, on the other hand, he might be subject to that kind of long arm, if you will, the long international arm of U.S. law. But in addition to saying that he's not only innocent, but he's defying the United States on the score, there's considerable speculation developing in the Venezuelan media and regionally that the U.S. is, in essence, setting Maduro up for a very difficult period in which, having rejected this offer of an amnesty or a dismissal of these charges, he would then be declared an outlaw and would be subject to a potential assassination by the United States on the grounds that he's a criminal who has defied U.S. law. This is a very precarious situation, but given that earlier assassination attempts were mounted, notably the one I mentioned under the Trump administration, which was said to have been organized by the then National Security Advisor under Trump, John Bolton. And possibly, according to some U.S. media, carried out in spite of Trump's own misgivings about whether it was appropriate. I have not seen any indication that Trump had renounced this. But the situation is not going to get any easier with the continued drumbeat in the media here that based on the word of the defeated candidates in the election in Venezuela, that they won, and the continuing repetition, if you will, of that line of attack on the legitimacy of Maduro's regime, were being set up for a potential conflagration that will be very, very difficult to control. I'm going to leave that there.
Perfect. Perfect ending. Well, that's all the time we have for tonight's program. That was Doug Vaughn, Doug covering Central and South America and the Caribbean Basin as well. And I want to thank the panel for another fine job. The panelists were Doug Vaughn, Yukari Miyamai, and Joe Yuhas. And we hope that Ibrahim Kazrouni can join us again. He is having some personal issues. So I've been your host, Jim Nelson. Tune in next month for another edition of the International Press Review.